Pam and I are thrilled that Ballsy is sponsoring this episode of our True Crime Podcast. Ballsy has fun, high-quality products made right here in the USA that focus on below-the-belt care for men. Check them out at ballwash.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, this podcast, truly one of the most unusual ever recorded, contains dribble, slang, and frank discussion of subject matter which under no circumstances should be heard by small children, persons with a heart condition, or anyone who is upset easily. If you are such a person, or if you're the parent of a very small child in the room, we urge you to switch off your streaming device now.
Hi, Jen.
Hey, Cam. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. I heard you have a special episode for us today.
Today, Jen, on our True Crime Podcast, we have a very special episode.
I loved those very special episodes. Are you pregnant? That's usually what they were about. Remember Silver Spoons on Ricky? Remember they Ricky had the Schroeder, very special? Yeah. Our special episode, shall we start?
Well, yes. I was just going to give you a little background, Jen.
Okay.
As you know, I have a problem with Netflix.
Yeah, you are a binger.
I watch way too many shows and I binge way too many shows. So I was working on this episode, as you know, and it was about a serial killer. Mm-hmm. And as I was watching Netflix, they had a little teaser of something that is the second season starts on Friday, this Friday, which is January 31st. They're releasing season two of I Am a Killer. Crunch. All right.
Very
so
cool.
I stopped writing about the serial killer and I thought, you know what? So when I watch these shows about these killers, of course, half the time that's how I find them, or I get down a rabbit hole and it takes me to another one and another, whatever.
Right.
So whenever I watched the first season, I would always look up the killer, find out, you know, some more information about him. And I thought, hey, Jen, why don't me and you do a little favor for people and kind of give them a little background on the killers that are going to be featured on I Am a Killer on Netflix, premiering Friday, January 31st.
Ooh, perfect.
Like I said, if somebody's on there, I got to look them up. I got to see what they look like. I got to see who they're talking about. I got, you know, I did the leg work for our listeners. Now, like I
awesome,
said,
thanks.
This is a little bit different than the other episodes we do. This is almost sort of like 10 mini episodes squished into a two-part episode of our True Crime Podcast, okay?
Ooh, cool.
I went in order of the first person to be featured on episode 1 through episode 10. Now, some of these people are on death row. Some of them got life. Some of them, there's been changes to their case. A couple of them I told you about, a couple I left off because I thought, you know what, you need to go watch the series to see what happened. And of course, you know, I'm sure I got details wrong because of the sources that I went through versus what they did. You know, if you haven't seen season one, it's still on Netflix. I rewatched it when I was doing this. They feature what the person did to end up where they are, but they also talk to loved ones, their parents, if they have them, their sister, but they also talk to the victim's people as well. It almost presents a, I guess, a well-rounded composite of the murderer or killer, okay? So this is more just their crime. You know, stick to the facts, ma'am. That's what kept going through my head as I was writing this.
So you're just writing short blurbs?
Kind of. I mean, it's just
short,
kind of
factual-based blurbs.
About their crime, basically.
Yes.
About who they are and what they did to end up there. So like I said, it's almost like 10 mini episodes. So interesting, just a little bit different, you know, like I said, at least now going in, if you are like me and you're going to binge watch that Friday, which I will, of course, you're already going to know a little bit about them, just as I do now, right?
Cool. All right. Let's hear it.
It was about 4:10 p.m. on September 15th. 2015, when witnesses called authorities to report a vehicle that was driving erratically in Billings, Montana. 45 minutes later, the Chevy Tahoe was located in a parking lot with a frantic woman beside it. The woman, and driver was 32-year-old Lindsay April Hagen. Located in the passenger seat was a man by the name of Robert Glenn Mast, age 25. Mast was unresponsive, so emergency personnel stepped in and attempted to perform CPR on him. But sadly, he was not able to be revived. Mast was pronounced dead at the scene. Now, here's a little tidbit for you. One source had him in the thing, and she was there. Another one had her screaming with him on the ground, and she was trying to do CPR on him, but failing miserably. I just went with that because whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Who knows? I mean, yeah. Obviously. I guess we'll find out on Friday, which it was, because she'll talk about it. Anywho.
She will.
So Lindsay was immediately taken into custody, and she would be interviewed regarding this rather bizarre situation. Lindsay waived her Miranda rights and willingly told officers she killed Robert Mast because he asked her to. Now, Lindsay claims that Robert Mast was a transient from South Florida, and the two of them had been dating since August. Now, mind you, this is only September. Mm-hmm. The couple were traveling from Olympia, Washington to North Dakota, but they had stopped in Billings at a Walmart to eat some pizza and drink some wine. I swear to God, Jen,
that's,
if I die in a Walmart parking
fantastic
lot.
Fantastic date ever.
As the couple were in the car, Lindsay claims that Robert Mast asked to die. Now, apparently, Lindsay has always had, I guess, a bit of a fantasy to, quote, kill someone with her bare hands, okay? She wanted to know what it felt like, and she thought, hey, I finally got my opportunity to do this because he's asking me to do it. Lindsay said that she then climbed into the back seat of the car and put her arm around Robert's neck as he sat in the passenger seat. So she was behind him, strangling him, basically. She described in detail the process of Robert's death to officers and said at one point he began to foam at the mouth. She said she then left the Walmart parking lot. Lindsay was leaving, I guess, the area to get rid of his body. So she did exit that parking lot. All of a sudden, had a change of heart, pulled into a Domino's parking lot, Domino's Pizza, which was located, you know, just like kind of right down the street. Mm-hmm. And it was here that she attempted and failed, basically, to perform CPR on Robert's lifeless body. Initially, Lindsay would deny that she was responsible for Robert's death, but then she changed as time went on, probably because she had to. That was part of the plea bargain, don't you know?
Of course there's a plea bargain.
Lindsay would plead guilty to deliberate homicide in exchange for a recommendation from prosecutors that she only receive a 65-year sentence. In Montana, the charge of deliberate homicide carries with it a sentence that could be as high as 10 years, and she didn't want that, so she went ahead and decided to do the plea agreement, hoping it would get her less time. Now, Lindsay, you see, Jen, she's a little unique in her background. Lindsay had served in the military for 10 years, and she even volunteered for a tour in Kuwait, where she was a gunner on a Black Hawk helicopter, which I thought that was pretty cool, really. I mean, terrible, but cool. She's not your average, you know, day worker, right? Like 8 to 5. That, I'm sure, was extremely stressful, which brings me to my next point. During court testimony, it was established that Lindsay had suffered some abuse during her lifetime. And you're going to see with every single one of these, this is what I texted you about the other day. Every single person in here, I believe, has suffered some sort of abuse.
A lot of them have.
A licensed clinical professional counselor named Lisa Matovich Brooke was brought in to testify about the state of Lindsay, the state of her mind, where she was, where she had been, and how it affected her. The counselor had stated that Lindsay's father was abusive towards her, which made it obviously a rough start for her in life. Leaving one abuser to another, she met a man, and the two, both in the military at the time, got engaged. The man would turn out to be less than kind. He would repeatedly rape and beat her, often. He broke her nose and her hand. He even almost killed her when he threw her across the room and it caused her head to hit the bathtub. And then he would end up strangling her until she passed out. That's, what is wrong with people? Seriously.
Yeah, that's not a very good loving relationship right there, is it now?
No. Lindsay, who was a sergeant at this time in the National Guard, got sick of the abuse. She went to her commanding officer and she told him everything that had happened to her. Her commander, in an effort to get her safe and keep her safe, decided to have Lindsay stay in the barracks on base. Now, she would still continue to reach out to her abuser slash ex-fiance during this time to keep in touch, which is, I mean, I've never been there. I don't know. The counselor would testify that all of this abuse led to PTSD as well as battered women's syndrome. Mm-hmm. And it was all of this that would lead to Lindsay trying to make Robert happy. So she complied with his request to kill him. That's the counselor's words, not mine or yours, mm-hmm. by the way. Prosecutors were not buying it, claiming that Lindsay did suffer some abuse. Maybe she did, but that in itself does not cause someone to take another person's life.
No.
Which I agree with.
It shouldn't.
Robert's stepmother, Mindy Pendleton, testified during the hearing saying that Mast was a traveler who was different than the rest of the family. He liked to kind of, you know, march to his own drum, as they say. Mm-hmm. He would kind of go state to state looking for work and work for a while, take off, travel. You know, I'd kind of say like a hippie. That's what it sounds like to me, which is fine. Mm-hmm. Totally fine. Love hippies. It's all good. Pendleton said, "His life mattered. It mattered. It mattered to all of us. He was loved and he was loved well." She would tell the court that she believed Lindsay should, in fact, spend the rest of her life in prison for taking Robert's life.
She should?
Lindsay should. Okay. The killer, not
the
mom.
Well, that's true.
Lindsay would testify in court stating, "I feel like I deserve whatever I get because I can't bring Robbie back." At the end of her testimony during the hearing, she requested 25 to 30 years of her sentence be suspended so that she could try to be a productive member of society again. After all, she had already served a good portion of her sentence. No, she didn't. In June 2016, Lindsay would stand before Yellowstone County District Judge Gregory Todd, boy, that's a mouthful, and plead guilty to the death of Robert Mast. Lindsay was sentenced to 60 years in the Montana State Women's Prison.
Wow.
So she got less than even, you know.
Yeah. I can't wait for that episode. That sounds really good. I'll be sure to watch that on Friday.
Friday. Here we go. We're moving on to episode 2, Jen.
Okay.
You like the vibe of this, how it's going? She's little blurbs. Some of these are longer, but you know.
Yeah.
Just did it in the order.
Just gave us a little bit. Make sure if we want to watch it or not.
There you go. Or now you know a little bit about Lindsay and
I
Robert.
Do. Fuckers.
Our next episode, episode 2, Jen, has a lot of components to it. Okay. So this is centered around juveniles committing a heinous crime. Which punishment should they get? You know, does the punishment fit the crime? If their brains are developed or not developed at that time, there's a lot to this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I just decided again to stick to the bare minimum because this one, I found a lot of info on this. This little guy. That's the joke there. His last name's Little.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It's January 25th, 1998 in San Antonio, Texas, when 17-year-old Leo Little, along with an accomplice named Jose, would kidnap and kill a 22-year-old man. But Leo Little's trouble started way before this cold Texas night.
Hmm.
Leo Gordon Little, known as Gordy by his friends and family, was left without a male father figure in his life at age 10 when his dad just simply left. Family and school officials noticed Gordy changed after that. He was not the same. He became very angry and troubled and even was called explosive by a school psychologist during a school evaluation at age 13. Now, this evaluation would even earn him the label of emotionally disturbed. Even though he seemed to possess an average IQ, he was taken out of regular education classes and placed into special education classes in an effort to better deal with his behavior. In 1993, the school district even said that Leo Gordy should be put into intensive therapy, but he was not. They told his mother he needed to be put in therapy and it needed to be intensive. They were seeing the writing on the wall, I guess. You know what I mean?
I don't know what he's done, but I can guarantee you if he's on the show that I bet you he should have probably got intensive therapy.
Mm-hmm. I would say so too. At home, Gordy was often left to care for his siblings as his mom was working long hours to make money to support the family. And, you know, probably looking back, this was not the best idea. It was documented that he threatened his mom with a knife to kill her, and he had repeatedly punched his sister in the head. He had a big temper, and he knew it, even stating, and this is Gordy saying this, "When somebody gets me mad, I go wild." Probably don't want to leave that kid home with your siblings, but I mean your children. But I get it.
Even with anybody, yeah.
Dad left. Mom had to work. She had to support him. I get it. As is so often the case, Jen, kids start with smaller crimes first. Gordy would be arrested as a teen for shoplifting. He was regularly doing drugs, from marijuana to much worse, such as heroin, coke, and crack. If he couldn't get his hands on these, he would sniff anything he could, such as gasoline, whiteout, felt markers, lighter fluid, you name it. And we all know that drug abuse does damage your brain, especially inhalants, right?
Exactly.
It's terrible.
You know, I never would have, I mean, I know that whiteout can give you a high, but I would have never.
Thank you. I thought the same thing. There was a big long list. I just picked out the best ones.
Yeah. I mean, I used to, at my dad's office, I used to play with whiteout all the time, but I would have never thought that it gave you a high because it didn't smell that strong.
Mm-hmm. No. And but, like felt markers. I always smell those.
Oh, but, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Not sniff them. I smell them.
And
right?
The Ditto machine and thing. Yeah, I don't. Weird. All right.
So, Jen, it would be this drug use that would actually keep him away from his dream. And his dream was he wanted to be a Marine. He wanted to join the Marines. But unfortunately, he failed that drug test. So he was left with few choices. That's when, looking for acceptance and love, he joined a gang. Or it's like a wannabe gang, really. Mm-hmm. And you know, in gangs, you get your monikers, your nicknames. So they gave him a nickname of Lil Crazy. Lil Crazy, right?
Lil Crazy.
Yeah. L-I apostrophe crazy. He even started rapping.
He did, because he had that moniker.
That's right. He's bad. He's in a gang and he's a rapper. Mm-hmm. At just 17 years old, Gordy was about to make his first foray into the dark side. Now, this was just about a week before this teenager would end up becoming a cruel killer that he is and got him into where he is today. 25-year-old Malachi Werbst would wake up early in the morning to find a person standing in his dark bedroom. How scary would that be? Honestly, you wake up and there's somebody standing at the foot of your bed.
Yeah, I'd crap myself. Seriously, it's awful.
Honestly, right? Mm-hmm. The stranger would force Malachi up from his deep sleep and force him into a car. The stranger would make him drive to not one, but two nearby ATMs to get money, at gunpoint, mind you. And Malachi was forced to withdraw money, giving the stranger right around $400. After getting the money, the man with the gun drove out to an abandoned area, leaving Malachi out in the dark and left with his car, which would be discovered not too far away. It was about a mile away, and it was stripped of everything, not bolted down. Malachi said the man was calm but forceful in his commands, all while wearing a baseball cap. This man would turn out to be Leo Gordy Little. Malachi survived. He was very fortunate.
You know, I cannot hear the name Malachi without thinking of Children of the Corn.
Thank you. Me neither. Little redhead. Me neither. Mm-hmm. Me neither. A week later, another man would not be so lucky. It was January 22nd, 1998, when a 22-year-old man named Antonio Christopher Chavez would meet Gordy and his friend, Jose. The two men, Gordy and Jose, were flying high on weed and mezcal. Now, mezcal is an alcoholic beverage that's made from agave. Agave? Agave? Agave. Sorry. Mm-hmm. Hope we don't get a bad review for that.
Well, God forbid we make mistakes in saying things.
Especially when you're talking fast, right?
And it's fucking 8 a.m. on a Sunday, but hey, whatever.
Okay. Yeah, right? Mm-hmm. You get up and do it, buddy. Anyway. The two men would pull over to use a bathroom in a restaurant. While waiting, Gordy saw a young man who was dressed very nicely go to his car and drop something in it and then go back into the restaurant. So Gordy sees this and just zooms in on it, right? Mm-hmm. Gordy decides, hey, this is our opportunity. He goes and he crawls inside the back of the young man's car, and he's just going to wait. He's going to wait for him. This is stuff that nightmares are made of, I'm telling you. It was only minutes later that Antonio returned to his car and he got in. He didn't even notice Gordy in the back seat. The car had not even made it out of the lot when a gun emerged and was pointed to Antonio, forcing him to drive to his apartment first, where they would get his ATM card, any money, anything like that. And then they went to a gas station to get gas and other stuff, I'm sure.
Right.
We'll get to that in a minute. This broke my heart. It really did. Antonio was then forced to drive south for about an hour. Once they reached this empty stretch of road, Antonio was walked out to the front of the car with the headlights on. He was told to kneel, and he did, right? Scared beyond what anybody could imagine. Little Crazy, aka Gordy, pointed a gun to the back of his head and shot 3 times.
Horrible.
Gordy and Jose would then drag Antonio's body off the road, and they drug it for a little while. There was a fence or something, and they kind of propped him up over there. Now, they assumed he was dead or, you know, would be dead any second. Jen, that poor kid lived for another 2 days.
Oh, you're kidding me.
No. Unbelievable.
Poor family, too.
Now, just as if this is a regular night, the teens, Gordy and Jose, they head on over to a friend's house in Antonio's car, by the way. And they go there, and they play video games. They play murder.
Yeah, they
play video games. Then they head out to Antonio's car and they steal the radio and whatever else is loose in the car. Now, during the abduction of the earlier victim, Malachi, the victim told police that his assailant said something that was very ominous to him. And he said the man slowly and calmly whispered in his ear, "If I get caught, I'm not going down for robbery. I'm going down for murder." Well, 1 week later, that's exactly what he did.
Well, that's whatever. It's fucking stupid is what that is.
During the trial,
somebody wants to say that he's got a pair of big balls. He's not just going to go in jail for stupid robbery.
Right?
He's going to kill somebody first.
At 17. During the trial, Gordy's defense lawyers knew it was not good, and they hoped to simply save him from the death penalty. Plain and, you know, that you're going down. Hopefully we can at least spare you from the death penalty. Now, evidence that the prosecutor in the state had included not only a videotape of Lil Crazy and Jose in that gas station store, but they had testimony from the friend's house where they went. The friend stated that they came, they were calm, they were cool, and, you know, we just played Nintendo and stuff. The teen with the young baby face took the stand and begged for forgiveness and said something just took over him that night and he just couldn't stop it. He just could not stop himself, right? Jurors would later state that they didn't believe a word of his empty apology, thank goodness, that Gordy had no remorse and would surely do it again if he had the chance.
Oh, yeah.
Now, here's what else bothered the jurors, and this broke my heart. Jurors said something that really, really bothered them, and like I told you, it does. In the video of them at that gas station, they had Antonio with them, right? Like, you can see him. And they noticed that Antonio had urinated his pants. He was so scared, right? So you could see that his pants, he had, you know.
Yeah.
Right?
Wouldn't you?
Totally. But that's the thing. Like, this guy's getting up begging for forgiveness up on the stand. But then you counter that with this poor young guy.
Right. He showed no empathy or forgiveness for the kid that he murdered. So he should never have gotten sympathy from the jury.
Thank you. Prosecutors were not forgiving, stating he stalked this guy and led him around town, made him use his credit card to buy gas, then took him out, shot him in the middle of nowhere, then drug him off to the side of the road where nobody would find him. And when somebody did find him the next morning, the poor kid was still alive, and all night long, he had been trying to get help. Sadly, he died 1 day after being found out there. Leo Gordy Little was found guilty and is now on death row.
Good. Let's burn him. Hang him high.
I just think, like I said, my kid's that age. I can't... Who is that evil? Like,
I don't think he was really evil. I think he just wanted everybody to think he had cojones. He wanted to be the cock of the walk. You know what I'm saying? I just don't.
Episode 3, Jen. You ready?
Yep, let's go.
72-year-old Ruth Predmore lives by herself in Marion, Ohio. And, you know, while she's getting up there in age, she likes to do things by herself. And she gets along pretty well, you know, for 72. I love that. Ruth keeps herself busy as the treasurer of the King's Daughters and Sons. Now, this is a charitable organization which collects pennies to support activities and various charities and things like that. So Ruth is treasurer, so she would keep the coins at her residence as well as other monies that they had accumulated or were able to raise.
Mm-hmm.
You see where this is going, Jen? Do you see how much money she has?
I do.
What's going to happen here?
Mm-hmm. I kind of do, yeah.
People suck.
They do.
One of her neighbors, Joseph Murphy, lived with his parents right down the street from Ruth. And he would occasionally do yard work for Ruth when, you know, she needed help getting that kind of stuff done. Things took a dark turn on January 27th, 1987. Ruth was shopping at a store nearby, and while she was there, she showed the sales clerk a note that she had received. The note stated, "You don't have no phone. I want your money. Put it in a bag and put it in your yard or I'll kill you tonight. No money, no life, tonight at 8 o'clock. Misspellings in lowercase where it should be uppercase.
So they were edumacated, right?
On February 1st, 1987, at approximately 7 p.m., Joseph Murphy left his parents' home clad in a blue t-shirt, blue jeans, tennis shoes, maroon vest, and a brown jacket with white fleece lining. That's important. I'm not really sure if it is or not, but it's in there anyway. He went to a local gas station on the corner of David Street and Bellefontaine Avenue and requested penny wrappers.
Like when you roll up pennies to take to the mm-hmm. bank? Okay. Mm-hmm. Just wanted to make sure that mm-hmm. everybody knew what that is.
I got you. A clerk provided some used penny wrappers, gave it to him. At approximately 9 p.m., Joseph telephoned his mother and informed her that he had found a credit card. At approximately 10:30 p.m., Joseph returned home. Although his hands and face were covered with blood, he displayed no cuts or bruises on his body. There was no blood on any of his clothing, including that fleece-lined jacket. I just added that. He explains that the blood, Jen, was the result of a fight.
Mm. Okay? Was he fighting for his right to party?
I think he was. I'm not sure. He then went into the bedroom of his brother, Michael, and they counted pennies and placed them in the paper penny wrappers that he had gotten earlier. The next morning, Joseph had a black bag of pennies and paper rolls, and he even offered his mother, "Do you want some of this?" Because she wanted, she was looking for some money for cigarettes. Mm. And he nicely said, "Hey, you want some pennies to go buy cigarettes?"
Well, that's nice. Okay.
Uh-huh. Right. Yep, sure it is. So the next morning, Jackie Valentine, who was a supervisor for this human services organization that would deliver, you know, meals on wheels kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
they were getting ready to deliver a meal to none other than Miss Ruth, right? And on February 2nd, 1987, Jackie Valentine received a telephone call informing her that Ruth had not responded when the meal was delivered to her home. Now, upon arriving at the home of Ruth, Jackie Valentine entered the unlocked door and discovered the lifeless body of Ruth. Jackie Valentine called the police immediately. Jackie Valentine. It sounds like a fake name, doesn't it?
Jackie Valentine. It sounds like a mobster name, doesn't it?
It does.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Jackie, two hearts, Valentine.
Mm.
The first officer to arrive on the scene was Detective Sammy L. Justice. Discovered footprints in blood on the front porch and blood splattered on the screen door and wooden front door. Thereafter, agents Robert D. Setzer and David Barnes of the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation and Identification, the BCI, I didn't even know existed, searched the house. They discovered in the living room the note that Ruth had previously shown to the sales lady, right?
Mm-hmm.
The agent took blood samples from the shoe prints that were found on the porch. Subsequent analysis revealed that the blood was that of Ruth's. Okay, that was her blood mm-hmm. on the front porch in the shoe prints.
Right, but we kind of knew that, correct?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, which I think you could pretty much surmise.
Right.
On February 3rd, 1987, Joseph entered Lawson's store. Now, this is like a retail store, I'm assuming. Showed the manager some rolled pennies in a dark bag and asked whether she would exchange the coins for currency. The manager declined. I don't know why, but I'm glad they did.
Most stores don't
Well, it's pennies. Like, why would you do that, right?
Well, you can get shortchanged. You just...
Yeah, I got you.
I worked at a grocery store and the bookstore. You weren't allowed to take stuff like that.
Yeah. So as all this is taking place, some of the members of the Murphy family were getting ready to travel to West Virginia. They were going out of town, and they kind of looked down the street, and they noticed all the police activity at Ruth's house. Now, Joseph appeared agitated, and he even said out loud, "Huh, I guess Mrs. Predmore must have been murdered."
Huh.
Probably not the first thing you think when you see police
officers
at somebody's house.
That's the weird thing to say.
Right?
Yeah, very weird thing to say.
Right after this, Joseph placed a telephone call to Cynthia Nichols. Now, Cynthia is his aunt. And during this phone conversation, Joseph would ask her if he could come and stay with her in her house, I guess, which was located in Caledonia, Ohio. After his aunt agreed, Joseph and his girlfriend Brenda departed for her place at approximately 8 p.m. After their arrival, Joseph admitted to his girlfriend that he, in fact, killed Ruth by slashing her throat with the knife he had taken from a collection of his brother's knives. Detective Wayne J. Crisup discovered a wallet belonging to Ruth underneath a shrub, which was approximately 50 yards from Joseph's house. So police had a suspect. They knew. Somebody knows something, you know what I'm saying? So they're going to go in there. Police go in and search the Murphy residence. And inside, they find a pair of gloves, a brown windbreaker jacket with that lovely white fleece lining.
Mm-hmm.
They also find a woman's purse, penny wrappers, rolled pennies, and a writing tablet that was actually the same type of paper that was used to give to Ruth, that note that I'm going to kill you or give me
oh,
the money
yeah.
note,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
They also located a pair of blood-stained blue jeans. Ding, ding, ding. They got their guy. Police then travel to Caledonia, arrest Joseph, and advise him of his rights to remain silent. At approximately 8:06 p.m., agents go and search the trailer of Cynthia Nichols. Among the items recovered there were a pair of tennis shoes and a maroon blood-stained vest. Subsequent analysis of the tennis shoes, the gloves, the jacket, the purse, the blue jeans all reveal the presence of type A blood. Now, Joseph and Ruth both had type A blood. 16% of the population have the type of blood with this particular enzyme factor that Ruth's blood had. It's confusing, so I'm just leaving that out, right? But
you will have to watch the documentary.
There you go. Joseph was transported to the Marion Police Station. During the interview, Sergeant John Gosnell had alluded to some other issues, shall we say, that Joseph has had in his past. And these included, and you're going to be shocked here, I'm telling you, Jen, arson and breaking and entering.
Huh.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
He decided he needed a break from the interview, Joseph did. Mm-hmm. So he shut down. But then he did go ahead and grant a second interview. Joseph, of course, denied any involvement in the death of Mrs. Ruth Predmore and implicated somebody else, which was his brother-in-law, instead. Joseph was so positive that his brother-in-law committed this crime that he volunteered to submit to a polygraph exam.
I bet you that went well for him.
No, sure did not, Jen. February 8th, police go in, and again, they search the Murphy residence. And it is here that they recover a knife, and the knife is lodged in the concrete foundation of the home. Now, this knife did belong to David Murphy, which was Joseph's brother. Remember, he had said that he took that knife from his brother. The analysis of the knife revealed traces of blood. Shortly after the search, Joseph's mother discovered a plastic bank card. Remember, he said, "Hey, I found an ATM card or credit card." Remember?
Look what I found. Yeah.
Right? And the card did have the name of Ruth Predmore on it. The card was located under our mattress in the basement.
Coincidence. What a coincidence.
It's just a coinky dink, right?
How did he manage to find that card of a woman that's been killed? Unreal.
Right?
What are the odds?
Joseph Murphy would stand trial in the brutal slaying of Ruth Predmore. Now, there are a few things that may or may not have contributed to Joseph's situation, how he turned out. And you know what I'm going to say here.
Always do.
A couple things. Joseph Murray's IQ is believed to be right in the 74 number range. Now, this is below average, and it indicates a borderline mental disability. His family would say that he was always treated as different by his family and his peers. But, you know, family's just part of the problem. Or maybe that's the start of the family.
Sometimes families are all of the problem.
Thank you. It was stated Joseph had a horrific childhood. Beginning at age 5, various relatives and family friends sexually abused him. According to Joseph, he was abused by 2 of his father's friends when he was just 5 years old and repeatedly raped by the son of his babysitter when he was between the ages of 6 and 8. Joseph also states that when he was being held at the Dayton Children's Psychiatric Hospital, an officer took him into seclusion with another inmate/kid. He told both of them to disrobe, and he photographed them posing in sexually suggestive positions. During a subsequent trial, like I said, I leave out tidbits of info so you see where this is going. During a subsequent trial, the psychologist was brought on the stand to evaluate his mental ability or disability, as well as his criminal responsibility and competency. Based on her review of Joseph's past hospitalizations of both Joseph and his family, the doctor concluded that either a borderline personality disorder with prominent antisocial features or mixed personality disorder. So he had one of those. In either case, Joseph's disorder is severe, chronic, and disabling. Her words, not mine. Okay. She then added the type of experiences that Joseph had early on were very much influential in his personality assets expressed today. I would say the opposite of assets, but okay, whatever. If he had had other experiences, I couldn't say what he would be like, but it's clear to me that those experiences very much affect how he looks at himself, how he looks at other people, and how he regulates his behavior. And there is a change to this case, Jen, like I said, but I'm not going to tell you. You're going to have to watch Netflix, I Am a Killer, premiering Friday to find out what happened to him.
Okay, I'll do it.
So that is episode 3.
Ladies, Valentine's Day is just around the corner. And if you're like me, you love to give your guy a gift that's different. A bit quirky and something that'll put a big smile on his face and yours. This year, I'm not messing around. I'm not making a nice dinner or a fancy dessert. I'm going to get ballsy. After 20 years together, it's time to spruce up my man's undercarriage. I'm giving my husband a little nut rub. That's right. I'm giving his balls the attention they deserve with products we both will enjoy. Nut Rub from Ballsy is a solid cologne that helps keep his dangly bits and body smelling fresh. You can purchase it on its own or in the Valentine's Day gift set, Your Incrediballs. That set comes with 3 Nut Rub solid colognes, including the limited edition Valentine's Day scent, Draft and Dunes. But that's not the set I'm getting. I'm getting Ballsy's I'm Nuts About You Valentine's Day gift set. This sack pack comes with Nut Rub, Ball Wash, which is a charcoal-activated nut butt and body wash, and a bottle of Sack Spray. Now, Sack Spray is the perfect deodorizer. Just give the boys a squirt or two after a workout and everyone's happy. Ballsy brand makes everyday men's grooming products fun. Made in the USA with essential oils and plant extracts. It's also cruelty-free, and no parabens, sulfates, or synthetic dyes will touch the family jewels with Ballsy products. So go to ballwash.com and order the I'm Nuts About You Valentine's Day Sack Pack. And make sure to use our code TRUECRIME20 and get 20% off your order. Once again, go to ballwash.com, order the I'm Nuts About You Valentine's Day Sack Pack, and use our code TRUECRIME20 and get 20% off your order. You'll be thanking me.
Episode 4, Linda Couch. Walter Douglas Couch, age 35, was a husky sort of guy who never smoked or drank. He was a hardworking man with a wife, Linda, and 3 children. So on October 13th, 1984, when Walter was shot in the head as he was sleeping on the sofa, the community was stunned. But when the truth would emerge, it was pure shock. So to get the full gist of the story, Jen, we got to go back a little bit. right? Sometimes you gotta go back to go forward. So here we go. 15 years earlier, when Walter would bring a 16-year-old girl named Linda home, his parents were kind of not too keen to the idea because Walter had wanted Linda to stay with the family, right? And she's 16. He is older than her, but still, right? That would be more than a little weird. Walter's mother was not very happy with this arrangement, and she even told him this. So Walter and Linda fixed the problem, Jen.
Oh, yeah?
They got married.
Oh, good.
So the couple would continue to live with Walter's parents even after the couple started having babies. Now, obviously, it's going to get crowded, and it would continue to get crowded as long as they're having children and continuing to live with Walter's parents. So Walter's dad, who was named Walter Sr., wanted nothing more than to have his son be happy. So he decided to sell the family home to his son for just a dollar. I mean, that's just so that you can say you bought it, right?
Right.
Walter Sr. and his wife, Dorothy, would move just down the street because they wanted to stay close to the family and the grandbabies and all that good stuff. In fact, I think they only moved like one house away. The grandchildren would come over and stay with the grandparents often. They would often eat dinner over there. Walter would pop in all the time, at least every few days. They would have to hear from him. So when Walter Jr. didn't stop by and 10 days had passed, both of his parents thought that was a little weird. But it had become fall, and, you know, maybe Walter was not feeling so good. That's what they thought, right? But Walter Sr. still kind of felt that something was off. So he decided to do a little investigating, which I admire him for this because I would too. Walter Sr. decided to swing by the courthouse and pull the deed on the house that Walter had given his son. Right? Because he did sell that to his son and his wife. Now, the odd feeling soon changed to disbelief with sickness. The deed possessed only one name on it, Linda Couch.
Ooh.
Walter Sr. hopped in the car, immediately went to get Dorothy from work because something was not right. I can't believe that the dad would automatically do that, you know? That's a little odd. Because
why?
I don't know. Like, that just wouldn't be my first thought.
And they must have known something about her.
A little bit weird,
or suspected,
right?
Yeah.
So Walter's parents go directly to their son's house. Now, you see, it was just a few weeks ago, Jen, that the three children, Douglas, Roxanne, and Danielle, had all helped their mom fix that erosion problem she had in her yard, you see?
Oh, mm-hmm.
There was an erosion problem out there, and she had asked the kids to help her dig a hole. They were going to fix this erosion problem by placing a giant red carpet that was held together by clothesline.
Oh, I bet you. I know it was so, in that car.
It was
rug.
For the erosion problem, Jen. Mm-hmm. It was for the erosion problem. So they took that rug and they shoved it down in that hole that they had dug, you know, sealing up the hole, put all the dirt back on it. And yeah, so they did that. So thinking back to that, Walter Sr., now, I mean, honestly, he's like, how did I not put this all together? How did I not realize that this had happened?
Right.
Linda Lee Couch, at just 30 years old, would stand trial as she was facing aggravated murder charges in a Hamilton County courthouse. The question was whether it was an accident, which is what she says, or if it was murder and done on purpose. Now, there was no question, however, as to the burial of Walter's body, as Linda admitted that she did, in fact, bury her husband in the yard with the help of her three children. How sick is that? Right? And the kids didn't know. They're kids.
Well, we'd hope the kids didn't know. And I hope if the kids knew, they would have said something.
In the end, Linda was sentenced to life in prison for what Hamilton County prosecutor Joe Dieters called the cold, calculated killing of her husband in 1985.
Wow.
Now, Linda Couch would weep openly and held a rosary during her trial for the murder of her husband, Walter. She even reenacted the shooting, like how it went down. She called it an accident, even though he was shot in the back of his head, by the way.
It's kind of a hard accident to have.
To cover it up, she then buried his body in a shallow grave. Linda said he hit her the night she shot him, and in fact, it was an accident as they were struggling over the gun, and it went off and shot him in the back of the head, I suppose. Investigators disagreed, saying that this was how all this happened, and it was much worse than an accident. They claim that Linda forged the deed of the house to herself and transferred it into her name without his name. It was 10 days after this that she bought a gun and picked it up the day before. She then sent the kids to the grandparents' house for the weekend. Walter was killed that Saturday. The following week, she spent $1,300 on new furniture, a new car, and a vacation to Gatlinburg, Tennessee. It's an accident, though.
It is an accident.
It's an accident.
It's an accident, but I'll be damned, I'm going to get new furniture.
Linda then told her kids, when they came home from their grandparents, that their father had left them. Linda got her children, a neighbor, and his own father, Walter Sr., to help with the digging of that hole that would eventually become Walter's grave. It was so hard for Walter Sr. to be like, why didn't I put that together, right? Because he actually helped dig that grave a little bit for the erosion problem. Yeah. Walter's father became suspicious and came back. And actually, this is awful, dug into that area, and he did locate his son in that area. How awful is that? That's terrible.
It's horrible.
Now, the prosecution said motive of the murderous plot was that Linda was tired of her marriage and wanted out. The jury agreed. Linda was sentenced to life in prison. Now, Jen, you'd think it'd end right there. But Jen, no, there's always more to the story. You know how it is. So after all this, Linda claimed that Walter was very abusive to her, which, I mean, that could have been the case, right? And when she married him, she was young and dumb and naive and in love, like many of us are. I get it. But as time went on, Linda said the abuse just got worse and worse. And it was one event that finally led to the end of Walter. Linda would tell a story about how one night she was woken up by all of Walter's friends who were partying at their house, I guess. And she was woken up and Walter told her that he said, and this is her words, he said they wanted a part of me. I was raped by all his friends and Walt just watched and laughed. I felt trapped. Anytime his friends came over, that would happen. Slowly but surely, he was bringing me to a breakdown. That's what she claims. Check out episode 4, Linda Couch, on I Am a Killer, Netflix, premiering Friday.
January 31st, right?
Yeah, I was going to say September 31st, so... Jen.
Yes.
You ready?
I am.
This is our final episode in part one.
Woo. It's a two-parter.
Jen, guess what?
What?
We're coming to St. Louis for this one.
Ooh.
I'm curious to see if you've heard of this dude. Episode 5, David Barnett.
I know the name.
You ready? Mm-hmm. You might too. It's about 8 a.m. on Sunday, February 4th, 1996. 19-year-old David Barnett walked to the home of his grandparents, Clifford and Leona Barnett, who were away attending church on this very early Sunday morning. And they attended church at the Kirkwood Baptist Church.
The what Baptist Church?
Kirkwood.
Kirkwood.
You know, in St. Louis.
Yeah, okay.
Kirkwood. That's why I shoved that in there, because we know where Kirkwood is and stuff. Right?
It's a cute little...
It's adorable.
Town.
David entered the home through a bedroom window, also a door that was slightly ajar. Different places had different things, but I went with the bedroom window because I found that more than the door. The Barnetts were attending church services at the Kirkwood Baptist Church. And we know where Kirkwood is. Adorable little town, right, Jen?
It's adorable. I love it.
David entered the room through a bedroom window or a door that's ajar. I found different things, but I went with the bedroom window. He sat down on the couch and turned on the television, and he soon fell asleep. When he awoke, he phoned his stepbrother, Scott, and boasted that he had just won the lottery last night and had suddenly come into a large sum of money. Jen, if you ever call me and tell me that, I don't even know what I'd say. I'm just saying.
Why?
I don't know. I'd just be happy, and then I'd be mad because it should be me.
Of course.
It'd always be me. Duh.
I know. It's always about you.
David Barnett was waiting for his grandparents when they returned home around 1 p.m. that day. His grandmother would say something to him, which apparently angered him. Something about falling asleep again, or I don't know. In any case, it angered him. And David would later testify that he ran over to her and pushed his grandmother down.
Aw, sweetie.
As he was doing this, his grandfather heard the ordeal in the other room, and he stepped in, grabbing David. David said he pushed her down in the hallway. He then pushed his grandfather to the floor, kicked him in the head, while his grandfather grabbed David by the ankle. While his grandfather was on the ground, David grabbed a knife that was lying on a nearby kitchen table and stabbed his grandfather in the neck. David inflicted 10 stab wounds and numerous cuts to his grandfather's neck, face, and hands. What is wrong with people?
I've been saying that all my life. I don't know.
After he killed his grandfather, David returned to the kitchen to get 2 more knives and then began stabbing his grandmother in the neck as well. She suffered a total of 12 stab wounds to her neck and numerous cuts to her face. After the attack, David took one of the knives and hid it in the bedroom between a mattress and box spring. Why he took one knife and hid it when there were several, I have no idea. I guess, obviously, he's not thinking straight. Panicking and realizing he needed to get out of the house, David goes to the bathroom, washes off the blood off his hands and face. He goes and gets into his dead grandmother's purse, takes out $120 from it. He removed the keys to the 1995 Dodge Intrepid that were dangling from the lock in the back door, got on his coat. Now, before leaving the house, this was interesting to me, and I'm not sure why. Before leaving the house, David would not go back and look at what he had done to his poor grandparents that only loved him, mind you. But instead, he stood quietly to hear if they were still breathing. He didn't go look at them. He didn't check on them. He just was silent to hear if he could hear breathing. After determining that his victims were in fact dead, David pulled the shades down in the house as if to hide what he did. I don't know. Locked the house up and drove off in his grandparents' car. David took the stolen car to join up with some friends to enjoy a night out with them. What's wrong with these people? After a night of partying, David would head to his friend's house on Texas Avenue, and this was around 3 a.m., where he would end up staying for the next couple hours.
On Texas Avenue?
Texas Avenue.
Yeah.
Don't. I don't know if that's in Kirkwood, because you know there's a Texas, and I'm guessing.
It's,
I don't know.
Well, it's a state street. You don't, and St. Louis state streets are not the best streets to go hang out on.
Correct.
Usually. That's the general rule of thumb.
Yes. Early the next morning, police officers were out and about, and they ended up, oddly, and I'm not quite sure how this came about, they stumbled upon David Barnett. When they saw him, the officers were, they weren't in uniform. They were, I don't even.
Were they off duty?
Duty? I'm not even quite sure. Like I said, a lot of these things, I couldn't even find a lot on them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
One source said that he walked out of the house and the 2 officers were there because they located the car that at this time I don't even think had been reported stolen, and he just admitted it. Another source says that he walked directly up to ununiformed officers and confessed that he had committed the murders. So I'm not sure which way it went, but in any case,
I wonder if he was doing drugs.
Something, right?
Mm-hmm.
David, who now at this time is 20 years old, would stand trial in St. Louis County Circuit Court facing 2 counts of first-degree murder of his grandparents. The state would be seeking the death penalty, while his attorneys would want a lesser amount, stating that David didn't plan to commit the violent act, but instead just kind of did it, right? Wasn't premeditated, is what they're claiming. David would be convicted on 2 counts of first-degree murder by the jury. David's attorneys argued for leniency, citing, you ready? What problem did David have? You know.
A mental illness.
Mm-hmm. And what else?
Drug addiction, sexual abuse.
There you go. His attorneys had argued that David had suffered from depression, bipolar disorder, and post-traumatic stress disorder from a troubled and unstable childhood.
Okay. Well, David. If he was living with his grandparents. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
David was suicidal at age 8 and again at 15, and later overdosed on prescription drugs and once set himself on fire.
Oh.
Prosecutors were like, whatever the bottom line is, David murdered for money, and the crime was outrageously vile.
I think he was pissed off at his grandparents that he murdered. That's why he murdered them, right? It started off as that, and then he just took the money as an afterthought. Or did I hear that all wrong?
No, that's probably about right.
Yeah,
probably.
Okay.
But let's take a little bit deeper look-see here. Deliberations would last 16 hours over 2 days, and when the jurors returned, it was death. Jurors found aggravating circumstances, including that the killings were unreasonably brutal and that he committed repeated and excessive acts of physical abuse, which I guess he did, like going back to his grandma and then making sure they, you know, he could hear that they weren't breathing versus a gunshot wound, right, to the head, one. David got some new attorneys and appealed in 1999. Again, in 2012, his attorneys appealed again, citing a new U.S. Supreme Court ruling. Again, they were turned down. But we're not done yet. We're never done yet, Jen.
Of course not.
In August and September of 2014, his case was looked at and included 9 days of hearings to listen to evidence that they had not been privy to before. Apparently, there were things that were left out and possibly could have changed the jury's mind over the penalty they gave him. Now, some of these things included sex abuse allegations, which would be powerful evidence, end quote, for the jury to consider. One of these abusers was David's biological father, which included sexual and physical abuse. Another abuser was his biological mother, who allegedly continued to drink and take pills while she was pregnant. And, you know, she wanted to stay awake and party longer. That's why she took the drugs and drank while pregnant with him. Now, a side note here is that apparently David's mother wanted to leave David in the hospital right after she gave birth to him, but one of her friends actually talked her into keeping the baby and taking him home, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if that's not bad enough, looking back, if it's true, David would have been better off abandoned in that hospital because David's mother would continue to try to get rid of him, to give him away over the years. And this included giving him to a, quote, suicidal, drug-addicted prostitute by the name Crazy Jane, as well as attempting to give David several times to the boyfriend of a sister of her friend.
Oh, Lord.
And according to that testimony, that man, David would later testify, was a mean, violent alcoholic. And he, that's terrible. He recalled being touched sexually by female house guests, having his nose smashed into somebody, and having someone pour dishwashing liquid down his throat. And that was at the man his mother tried to give him away to several times, or did give him,
how
I guess,
horrible.
And he came back.
How horrible.
At age 5, David Barnett was taken away and shuffled through a series of foster homes before being adopted by the son of his grandparents, right? The son of his victims. So one of the jurors later stated that, "I've never read where there was so much rejection in one life. David Barnett faced so much rejection in his young life, it had to do some permanent damage. But does that justify the murder of those that only tried to love him?" And that's the question, right?
Right.
So that, my friend, concludes our first series.
Dun, dun, dun.
The first 5 episodes of Netflix, I Am a Killer, premiering on Netflix Friday, January 31st, this Friday.
This is real.
Just a couple days.
I honestly can't wait to watch this, but now that you're doing this, I know which ones I can watch first because which ones I'm more interested in. Like, I'll probably do that one, not only because it's in St. Louis, but it's the guy's background's pretty effed up. And
really, and young. Again,
and
young.
Super young. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like he had severe mental issues due to his childhood. And
I would say so.
He had anger issues and can all that. Yeah. So I think I'm going to watch that one first.
Well, I'm glad because our next episode, which we'll be playing tomorrow after you hear this, has a few more from the Missouri area.
Oh, good.
So anyway, Jen, I hope you enjoyed that. Like I said, it's a little bit different, but me, I would eat this up because I'm nosy and I was like, I would like to help out somebody, right? And like you said, you just picked out the one that you would like to watch first because on Netflix, God love them, they usually release everything at the same time.
Right.
So then you can kind of pick and choose which way you go, right?
Right. And yeah, and with for me, I don't have time to sit and watch everything at once most of the time. I have to kind
of...
I know. I have to kind of pick and choose because I have
things.
People bugging me all the time.
Not
that I don't love them.
My little babies are just angels. They're just gifts from God. I'll tell you what. Never do the wrong thing ever.
I know. You're so lucky. But really anyway, yeah, this is really... Number 5 is on my list so far as number 1 to watch. Ha! Mm-hmm. Perfect.
Just wait.
All right. Okay. Stay tuned to listen to a promo from our friends at Ghost Town Podcast.
And right after that, our glorious bloopers. So remember, Jen, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Oh, bye-bye.
Love ya.
Today's episode was researched and written by me, Cam. For more information about this episode, as well as all the sources I used, please check out our show notes or the podcast website at ourtruecrimepodcast.com. Our True Crime Podcast is developed and created by hosts Jen and Cam. Original music and audio mix of all our True Crime Podcast episodes is courtesy of Nico Vertese from We Talk of Dreams. Listener discretion is provided by Edward October from October Pod VHS. Our True Crime Podcast is executive produced by Nico Vertese and Dick Vane. Make sure to like and subscribe to Our True Crime Podcast wherever you listen to your podcast. We can be reached on Instagram and Facebook at Our True Crime Podcast or on Twitter at Our True Crime Pod. You can email us at ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. If you really like the show, make sure to check out our Patreon at Our True Crime Podcast. Our True Crime Podcast is an OTC production.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Lieb.
And I'm Jason Horton.
And we're the hosts of Ghost Town, a comedy podcast about all places abandoned, tragic, mysterious, haunted, and true crimey.
That's not a word. We cover all kinds of locations like
the Los Feliz Murder House,
an L.A. murder frozen in time, Action Park,
the world's most dangerous amusement park, JonBenet Ramsey's house, Woodstock 99, the Cecil Hotel, and the Black House.
Ooh, Satan. Mm. So pause the podcast you're currently listening to immediately and go subscribe to Ghost Town.
You can find us at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, Jen, it's a very special Our True Crime Podcast episode. Did that all come out right? I hope it did.
Kind of, it sounded like you had a stroke in the middle of the podcast.
Did kind of,
but
I did.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. We'll do that again.
That's usually what they were about. Remember Silver Spoons on Ricky? Remember they had the very special?
Schrader.
Yeah. I was at my dad's. It was right after my parents got a divorce, and I was at my dad's, and he had made me dinner. And we were going to watch Silver Spoons, and they had the very special episode come on. And it was Ricky's friend got pregnant, and my dad very awkwardly, while looking down into his plate, said, "Do you know you could always come to me and talk to me about anything if you need?" And then, like, shoveled food in his mouth because he was...
Poor Tom. That is... Oh, my God.
I remembered that it was so awkward, and I wanted to crawl under the table and die.
Oh, yeah.
But then looking back on it, it was just like, I know it took... everything out of him.
Well,
to say that, you know, because he hates to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That was taboo subject. Yeah, it was funny.
Poor Tom.
All right.
If I die in a Walmart parking lot, you are to immediately come and get me and move me to somewhere much better. I'm just saying. I don't want that to be in my headline. You know what
I thought I was supposed to get all your sex toys out of your drawer.
Well, that too. Speaking of which, did you see what I put on Twitter today? That was god awful. The girl. Vibrator stuck up her what urethra?
Oh, that happens all the time.
No. The urethra. Urethra.
No, I know it happens. Yeah. Our little friend Kim from People Are Wild. She is an ER nurse, and she talks about stuff like that a lot. Usually, they accidentally fall on them. But yeah,
this was in the urethra. You got that right. The bladder.
No.
The bladder.
Not the back door.
Not the front door, but the attic door.
Right. No, I haven't had a chance to read it, but I saw it. But yeah, it happens more than you think it does. But yeah, I'll have to read it when we're done here.
Thanks, no thanks. All right, back to our show. Nico, you put that in wherever you want to put it. I don't care. Just don't put it, you know where.
In your urethra. Get it? Get it?
Yeah.
Good way to bring that joke all the way around, Camille.
Thanks, I try. Here we go. It's January 25th, 1998 in San Antonio, Texas, when a 17-year-old named Leo Little, along with an accomplice named, these names, I'm telling you, Jose Zavalas. I'm going to go with Jose. We're going to back that up. Back that thing up. Back that thing. Okay, sorry.
Dark.
I know, I tried. Even though he seemed to possess an average IQ, let me just say for the record, if I get to be a detective, I want my last name to be Justice.
Well, this almost sounds made up. You got Jackie Valentine, you've got the Justice guy. Yeah.
Murphy.
Mm-hmm. Murphy mm-hmm. Justice. Mm-hmm. Hi, my name's Murphy. Murphy Justice.
No, it's Detective. That's why it's better.
Detective. My name's,
Detective Samuel Justice. At your service. Okay. Sorry. You can cut all that out, Nico. Still funny, though.
Or edit slippers or whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
Just
first off,
try to make it sound smart, not like your boyfriend's bimbo girlfriend, or not like your best friend's bimbo stupid girlfriend.
Witty, dim-witted girlfriend.
Fuck him. That's all I have to say. Fuck.
I was like,
him.
Honestly, Jen, I was like, you and I had just talked about this. Like, maybe it was at work. I don't remember. But I was telling somebody, and I said, I think the worst insult is to be called stupid. Like, that you're just not very smart, right? That you're not bright. Because you can lose weight. You can have a facelift. There's no IQ lift for your brain. No. Like, you're dumb. You're stuck with it. And then that reviewer said, we were dumb.
I know the term agoraphobia. It's fucking early in the morning when we do this. We've said this before. Sometimes your brain doesn't say right.
Say, you don't even catch it. Yeah.
And not only that, sometimes you do mispronounce words. St. Louis, envelope, epitome.
Cavite.
Sometimes it happens. But we have so many others that said that they like us. And fuck him if he doesn't like it.
It's okay.
A woman. We have 85% of our listeners are women. So, and I think only 10% of our listeners are 60-year-old men.
That we know of. I don't know.
Well, from Spotify.
I'm kidding. Yeah. It was a joke. Just a joke.
All right. But still.
Back to the story.
Fuck them. Yeah, sorry.
Sorry. I'm just scrolling the paper up here.
Scrolling. Keep that pewter going.
Right.
Man, my butt is swollen.
During the sexy.